This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. This was supposed to be the summer of immigration action. It wasn't. President Obama this week announced there won't be any action on immigration until after the midterm elections. Instead, this summer saw pressure building in both political parties for policy changes. Now, the debate has been particularly intense thanks to thousands of migrant kids escaping drug gang violence in Central America this summer, crossing the U.S. border illegally, looking for safety, and in some cases, relatives. Here's President Obama on Meet the Press last weekend.
This problem with unaccompanied children that we saw a couple of weeks ago, where you had from Central America a surge of kids who were showing up at the border, got a lot of attention. And a lot of Americans started thinking, we've got this immigration crisis on our hands. Now, the fact of the matter is that the number of people apprehended crossing our borders has plummeted over the course of the decade. It's far lower than it was 10 years ago. And in terms of these unaccompanied children, we've actually systematically worked through the problem so that the surge in June dropped in July, dropped further in August. It's now below what it was last year. But that's not the impression on people's minds. And what I want to do is, when I take executive action, I want to make sure that it's sustainable.
But that executive action was not coming this summer. Back in June, the president promised to take action by the end of this summer. Now he's delayed action as Democrats in close races this fall face voter pressure from the right. Florida Republican Congressman Joe Garcia and Ileana Ross-Layton saw the politics behind the delay.
I'm disappointed, but, you know, I'm angry at the other side.
He's obviously doing it to protect the Senate Democrats and to have them not lose their seat.
Immigration reform supporters, meantime, say there has been no action in at least a decade on immigration, no clear guidance on how to handle these migrant kids. So do you support the delay on immigration reform from the White House? How should immigration be addressed in the coming year? And how does the issue play in a swing state like Florida ahead of the 2016 presidential election cycle? Join us here on the Florida Roundup on the phone, 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, online at WLRN.org, or on Twitter, use the call sign at WLRN. Joining us on immigration, covering the Americas for us here at WLRN, Tim Padgett and Al Chardy from El Nuevo Herald. Tim, first of all, the reaction to the president's delay in Florida was what?
I think it's mixed, because in Florida, you really don't have the urgency amongst the population on this issue that you would say in the Southwest. This is not a Mexican-American heavy population here. And let's face it, you know, the two-thirds of the Latino population in this country is Mexican-American, and immigration reform affects them most directly. It does not affect really Cuban Americans, not Puerto Rican Americans, and those make up the vast majority of Latinos in this state. We do have a much larger influx of Central Americans these days over the past decade, but not really large enough for it to make it a real, you know, five alarm fire issue here.
Yeah, we are seeing more and more of those Central Americans come to South Florida. Al Chardy with El Nuevo Herald. The president's decision, of course, coming as Florida continues to absorb some of these migrant kids. What's the process currently for these migrant children?
Well, the children who arrive at the border are held initially in various detention cells or centers that Customs and Border Protection largely operate along the southwest border. Then after they find their relatives, mostly their parents, they are transferred to them via airplane rides or bus tickets. And South Florida has been receiving some of the largest numbers.
Third largest amount from any large regional area, is that right? Yeah.
Yes.
And what parts of South Florida do we know that they're wind up settling in?
Well, mostly in Miami-Dade, Palm Beach, and Broward counties, and some in Martin County, some in Orlando, Tampa, most of the large cities, but the vast majority of almost 3,000, well, 2,500 are coming to Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach.
And the politics of this here, Tim, and the president's decision, the optics are a little bit different here in Florida. We don't have a Senate race in this cycle in 2014, and perhaps that gives the president in this purple state, this swing state, a bit more breathing room in addition to the immigration nuances that you mentioned earlier, don't you think?
Well, the political math involved in this can seem about as easy to understand as my kids' pre-calculus homework, but it boils down to this. Which block of voters does you the least harm and does you the most good if they simply stay home on November 4th? Obama and the White House have calculated that it does them the least harm if Latinos stay away from the polls, and it does them the most good if white conservatives don't come out in droves to vote and thereby jeopardize Democrats' chances of holding on to the Senate, as Ileana just mentioned there. But acting on immigration before the election would have mobilized white conservative voters. Not acting will mean apathy from Latinos, but in politics, as you know, you usually opt for the lesser of two evils.
This is political addition by subtraction, essentially, keeping people unmotivated to show up at the polls in November.
Right, and there will be a quiz on this later in the show.
just like there is in pre-calculus. The Florida Roundup is your program as well. You can join us at 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Dave joins the program from Miami. Go ahead, Dave. Dave, are you with us? There you go.
Yeah.
Go ahead, sir.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. No, I'd like to comment on Ileana Ross-Layton. Who is she to criticize any immigration policy when she herself toes the party line on immigration policy and elects a self-serving policy of keeping other Latinos out, but let the Cubans in, no questions asked?
Dave,
you know, who is she to criticize anything?
Dave in Miami, thanks for the phone call. Al Chardy, Dave giving voice to a very popular criticism of federal immigration policy, especially as it relates to the special carve out that has existed for many, many years for Cubans.
Yeah, but that portrayal doesn't really fit Ileana Ross-Layton because she has been a champion of immigration reform. Despite a lot of opposition within her own party. So what would be her criticism or actions against immigration reform? I don't know.
Let's talk about the options that the president really has even after the November election. Okay, so the White House has come out. It's going, the president in June had promised an executive action on immigration before the end of the summer. The week after Labor Day, he says, no, it's not going to happen after all. It'll happen after the midterm elections. Political calculations or calculus involved here, Tim, may be in play. What are the options truly that are on the table for the president?
Well, after the election, I think it will be safer for him then, you know, if the Democrats are able to hold on to the Senate, it's safer for him to then pursue some of these executive actions like cut back on deportations, things that the Latino community does want, particularly the Mexican-American community. And that sort of builds then, again, that Latino vote enthusiasm for the 2016 presidential election, which they'll need. And let's not forget that in 2012, Obama, with the promise of immigration reform, was able to get this remarkable more than 70% share of the Latino vote. They need that again in 2016.
Al Chardy with El Nuevo Herald. The president has consistently pledged action on immigration throughout both of his terms. In fact, he had promised action immigration reform in his first year of his first term. Of course, he ran into the Great Recession and the housing collapse and the financial mess that he had happened to inherit, but there was no action then. In 2012, he ran on a platform that talked about immigration reform, talked about addressing undocumented children, the Dreamers Act, for instance. So how often can the president go to that line of the pledge of action before this voting bloc, as Tim mentioned, which supported the president significantly in 2012, winds up in other places on Election Day?
Well, I don't. It's a really difficult and interesting situation there because he's not running for office again.
That's right.
So I don't think that will affect him one way or the other. The aftermath of the fallout may affect whoever the Democratic candidate may be for 2016, whether that person will pick up immigration reform or not, whether a whole flock of Hispanics are going to gravitate toward the Republicans in a revenge vote. Well, that's the question, or whether they will stick with the Democrats. Because they're hoping that maybe there might be some change down the road.
Yeah, well, let's hear from the electorate. Is immigration a swing issue for you as you look at the 2016 election cycle? 1-800-743-9576. You may think it crazy to think about an election 2.5 years away, but let's face it, that's where the calculus is at today. 800-743-WLRN is the phone number to join us here on the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson, along with Tim Padgett of WLRN and Al Chardy with El Nuevo Herald. I want to get back to the options that the president has, Al. after the midterm elections. Tim spoke about deportations. We know, according to an AP analysis of the Department of Homeland Security, there has been a decrease in deportations so far this year. The president had been described by some immigration reform supporters as the deporter in chief, as recently as just a few months ago, for instance. The issue of granting legal status to undocumented immigrants, allowing an on-ramp to legal status for the children of undocumented immigrants. What are the real options in executive action that the White House may be able to take if Congress is still in gridlock?
Well, based on conversations I've had with some congressional leaders, including Joe Garcia, who have been briefed by White House officials about the options they're looking at, it would be mainly two basic gestures. One would be, according to them, granting or extending the deferred action for deportation or deferring deportations for the parents of the Dreamers. That would be a significant block of people.
That would be an expansion of
DACA.
What was done in 2012, the deferred action for childhood arrivals, DACA.
Right.
DACA.
Correct. The other one would be extending the same action or some type of temporary protected status, like some many Central Americans have, to people who have no immigration status, but they have U.S. citizen spouses or children.
And with your sources on Capitol Hill that have talked to the White House feels confident they can do this without Capitol Hill.
Correct. On a temporary basis.
On a temporary basis, right. Randy here is going to join the conversation on the floor to Rhonda from West Palm Beach. Randy, go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to share that I've been listening to the immigration debate for a while, and I have yet to hear what I believe to be a viable strategy or plan from either side. I'm very disappointed that we don't have, first of all, a philosophical perspective that we as a nation on what our stance is on immigration, whether we want to let people in to help our economy and diversity, whether we want to keep people out and isolate ourselves. And I haven't heard an answer as to how we deal with the people who are here already in a fair and equitable way. I'm just waiting for one side to come up with a rational answer, and it hasn't come yet.
Well, Randy, I think you make some great points there in really splitting the immigration debate into those two tranches, which is how do we want to treat those who want to come here but aren't here yet? And Randy, I would offer to you that we have seen a limited amount through the years of desire to allow a highly skilled workforce from outside into the United States. We have these limits on certain kinds of visas, for instance, in the technology and science field, Tim, consistently. It's the low-skilled labor
exactly.
That really has been the source of the debate.
Yeah, I mean, aside... okay.
I was just going to say absolutely, but we don't have anybody addressing the low skill in the farms doing the migrant work where we need them, and we depend on them to cross the border illegally now.
Yeah, I mean, aside from the points that Al was just mentioning, I mean, the two big pillars of immigration reform from the beginning has been, one, this question of amnesty. You know, how do we figure out, you know, at what point do we let people get on a path to citizenship? The Republicans, and particularly conservatives, are very much against that. But I think the most important is because we are talking about immigration reform being mainly a factor of Mexican Americans, Central Americans, et cetera, the low-skilled workers, coming up with some sort of rational, if you don't want to call it a guest worker program, but some sort of rational mechanism to create, you know, a reasonable flow of workers coming in and out of this country. That is what I don't think, and this is where Randy's point is really well taken. He doesn't neither party has really come up with a plan for that, and until they do, immigration reform really doesn't have much of a future.
Absolutely,
Randy from West Palm, you're still with us here, but just curious as you think through immigration and you're completely unsatisfied with what's being articulated from either party, is this a swing issue for you in 2016 as you look forward?
Not at this point, because neither party has provided either a cogent leadership or a valid argument against the other side. There's nothing substantive on either side yet. I mean, I've lived overseas as an expat myself. I know what it means to live in a foreign country, and I know what it means to be welcome as an American in a foreign country. I don't see any mechanism yet that allows us to acknowledge that we need some influx, and some way to regulate that appropriately.
Randy from West Palm, thanks very much for the phone call and the insights. Al Chardy from El Nuevo Herald. To the point of Randy, there seems to be, you know, an inarticulate nature of the big idea. You know, famously in the first term of or the second term, I believe, of George W. Bush, immigration was called the third rail of national politics. Used to be Social Security reform, but now it's moved to immigration reform, I suppose. And certainly the Obama administration has bore that out.
Yes, I guess because to many people, immigration is as confusing or as complex as the IRS code. But in reality, American immigration laws are simple in general terms. You have to have a relative who claims you to be a legal immigrant. You have to have family immigration, which is a U.S. citizen wife, a U.S. citizen husband, children who claim you. Or a green card holder. That's one. Second, you have to have a job, a company that offers you a job and that they're willing to sponsor your green card immigration, your green card application. That's it. There are some additional issues like H-1B visas for business people.
For the high-skilled workers.
Right, yeah. High-skilled workers.
Those two pillars of immigration rules, as you mentioned, kind of date back to the mid-1980s, right. The last time Congress was able to agree on wholesale reform to immigration. It's been a generation since.
Yeah, but that's what they agreed on, family immigration. And that actually led to a dramatic change in the demographic makeup of the United States, because originally, before the 1960s, only people who came from the large historic immigration lines of the United States, like Europeans, would be granted immigration visas. After the 1960s, it was opened up, essentially, to the rest of the world. People who had family members or who had a job waiting for them with a company that was willing to pay for the green card.
How, Tim, has this debate of immigration evolved through the years, not only during the Obama administration, but, you know, dating back to that 1986 law that President Reagan was able to sign?
Well, that was the first big assignment I had as a journalist back in Chicago, was the 1986 reform. And, what fruits have we really benefited from, a generation later? And I think knowing the limits of what immigration reform can produce, I think, as you mentioned, the evolution, I think you're seeing more and more people in Washington and in places like here in the Southwest realize that immigration really isn't domestic policy. It's foreign policy. I think that
you agree with that, Al?
Yes, yeah, definitely.
That influx of kids that we've seen on the border this summer, I think, has taught us that President Calderon in Mexico, ex-President Calderon in Mexico, once said famously that spending $1 million on highways in Oaxaca, a very poor state in Mexico, would do more than $1 million on a wall on the border. Mm. To stem illegal immigration. And I think we're realizing that until we really get serious about creating better institutions in places like Central America, which is a violent mess today, we're really, building a wall on the border really isn't going to produce much in terms of stemming immigration.
Al Chardy, respond to that in terms of the engagement that we're seeing from political leaders on immigration, and if you are seeing them engage with it as a foreign policy debate or domestic political debate.
Well, I think it's mainly, as he says, a foreign policy debate that has now invaded the domestic debate as well, because whatever happens outside the United States is coming to affect us in the United States, like the children. They're fleeing gang violence, in many cases generated by gang leaders who were deported from the United States several years ago in large numbers under the Obama administration criminals first deportation policy.
We're going to take one more phone call on immigration here. Raul joins the Florida Roundup from Miami. Raul, go ahead.
Hey, hi, how are you guys? Thank you so much for having this conversation. I actually used to share with you, I'm an immigrant. I'm from Mexico, originally. And basically, first of all, I don't want to come over here. I came because opportunities. First of all, my point is, actually, after the U.S. with Mexico and Canada passed the Fair Trade Agreement, you know, NAFTA?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
After that, actually, the economy in Mexico, like just an average regular family, regular people, they have their own businesses and all that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
After happening, the Fair Trade Agreement, actually, we can compete with, let's say, with Walmart, with big, you know, supermarkets and all that.
Yeah, Raul, so, I think we got it. The idea is that, you know, immigration is about economics. Well, it's about international
exactly.
economics.
Raul is speaking exactly what Al and I have just been talking about in terms of, you know, foreign policy. NAFTA originally, back in early 1990s, was sort of a mechanism, or we thought would be a mechanism to create a better economy in Mexico and thereby stem illegal immigration. Hasn't always worked out that way, particularly for reasons Raul was just mentioning, that agriculture, farmers in Mexico sort of got left behind on this.
Yeah, yeah. Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here on WLRN. Al Chardy as well, covering all things immigration and otherwise for El Nuevo Herald. This is the Florida Roundup. Thanks to Raul and our other callers here. Still to come on our program, three Florida universities have some big vacancies to fill. The politics of university presidencies. Back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Help wanted at three Florida institutions of higher learning. Two big state schools, University of Florida and Florida State University, along with the private University of Miami, all are looking for new leaders. By the end of this academic year, the presidents of the schools will leave. While politics surrounds the selection of the new presidents at UF and especially at FSU, UM's next boss will succeed the popular and by most measures successful tenure of Donna Shalala. How about it, alum? Does it matter to you who the president of your school is? Does it affect any donation, any involvement that you have after you leave campus? What are the politics at the state schools? And how does the governor's race possibly impact who will lead Florida's two top public universities? Let us know here on the Florida Roundup at 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. You can tweet us using the call sign at WLRN. Tia Mitchell with the Tampa Bay Times joins us from Tallahassee, and John O'Connor with State Impact Florida here at WLRN covering education. Tia, let's start in Tallahassee. The search for the new leader at FSU has been, well, it's been troubled to say the least. What has happened on campus there?
Well, it's basically a philosophical decision that the school's Board of Trustees is going to make, and it's, do they want a traditional president who's risen the ranks in academia, or are they going to go with non-traditional State Senator John Thrasher, who is saying that his political connections and his fundraising prowess would be better for the university? And so as far as politicians go, Thrasher's probably much more controversial than maybe other politicians may have been, but he's also got a long history at Florida State. And so there are two camps, and I think both camps at this point are firmly in their own corners. And, mm-hmm. and so it's really just going to be a decision for the Board of Trustees to make as to what kind of person they want leading the university.
This presidential search has been called illegitimate by some. Students and faculty have been very vocal on campus in Tallahassee. Do they feel they have a vote with the trustees that are ultimately making this selection?
I think the trustees have tried their best to present the search as open, transparent. They say that, yes, we think Thrasher should be considered as a candidate. We want to keep him in the running. We want to hear from him. But they say repeatedly that it's not anyone's, you know, he's not being handed it. They, mm-hmm. they're going to consider the three others who are traditional academics. That being said, the students and the teachers who continue to oppose Senator Thrasher can give you numerous examples as to why they feel this process has not been transparent, that it has not been fair. But again, I just think the people in each corners, there's really not much that can be done to change their mind. If you think John Thrasher is being handed this job, then there's really nothing the Board of Trustees can do at this point to change your mind.
John O'Connor covering state impact education for us here at WLRN and statewide throughout Florida. This philosophical debate that Tia Mitchell describes between kind of a classic ladder of success in academia leading to a president's office of a large state university like FSU versus political connections and fundraising connections really gets to what is the president's office for? What is it designed for? Not in the past, but in the future. What is the future of a university president? What do we expect out of him or her?
Well, with, I mean, all due respect to anyone who puts the primary emphasis on academics. Academics are important, obviously, at a university, but a president's main job is still that networking. It's always going to be the main job. And as the kind of conditions of higher education change, there's even more emphasis on networking so that, you know, schools are, you know, having to do more with less. You know, particularly here in Florida, you're seeing, you know, we have some of the lowest college tuition, university tuition in the country, and yet we have those high expectations that the University of Florida or Florida State University and even the private University of Miami will be among the best universities in the country. So it's a difficult position for any college president to step into, high expectations and yet in some ways low funding. You also have issues with the governor in that the governor is determined to keep tuition low and to not raise tuition. And he's made that a point the last couple of years. And so there's this tension between the universities and the governor that where universities say, hey, we need more money. We need to raise tuition. And the governor has said no.
For those FSU grads in the audience, does it matter to you who's in that president's office in Tallahassee, an academic or a politician? Let us know, 800-743-9576. Would it impact any gift, any donation that you happen to have? 800-743-WLRN. Tia Mitchell, on this philosophical division between kind of what a university president ought to be made up of, on the political side for State Senator John Thrasher, is it your sense the opponents are against the idea of politicizing the office more than perhaps arguably it already is, or the politics specifically of this state senator?
I think it's two things, especially from the faculty. Faculty in general at an institution of higher learning want one of their own as president. So they want someone who has a terminal degree. They want someone who knows what it's like to teach students and conduct research. So in that case, it could be just about anyone in the faculty would probably have some concern. But John Thrasher takes it a step further because some of his politics are particularly controversial. For example, he has been very anti-union. Florida State faculty are unionized. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He's been in favor of some controversial policies in the legislature when it comes to paying teachers and tying it to test scores. And so, and also he's very partisan. He's co-chairman of Governor Rick Scott's reelection. He's former chairman of the Republican Party of Florida. And so again, from the political stand, there are many teachers and student groups who say this guy and his politics is not who we think Florida State University should be represented by.
Does the controversy wind up harming his possible candidacy? In other words, how effective he may be, Senator John Thrasher, if he's ultimately selected as the next president of Florida State University?
I think it does, but if he becomes president, and right now, again, there are four finalists, but he's the non-traditional one.
Yeah, the other three have traditional academic careers built up through the university systems, but all of them coming from outside FSU and outside the public university system in Florida.
Right. And so if he does become president, I think he will definitely have to do a lot of rebuilding and a lot of kind of reconciliation. And he knows that. He acknowledges that. He's tried to stress that he understands that if he gets the job, it won't be the partisan position that he's carried in the past. And he wants people to trust that he can make that transition, but not everyone believes it.
Not an election, but a selection at this point. We're talking about the search for three university presidents in the Sunshine State, two public universities, UF and FSU, and plenty of controversy in Tallahassee here on the Florida Roundup. 1-800-743-9576 is the phone number. Tony joins the conversation from Coconut Grove. Go ahead, Tony.
Yes, good afternoon. I just had a quick comment, and that's if the gentleman Thrasher is the best man for the job, then let him prove it. And I think also that the university president is more of a head of state type of position than a teaching position. So that's, I just thought I'd throw that in.
I appreciate that. Yeah, thanks for that insight, Tony, and thanks for the comments. Thanks for calling here on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-9576. In Gainesville, University of Florida, John O'Connor has kind of gone back and forth about its president's job. It was a year ago, it looked like there'd be a vacancy, and then there wasn't going to be a vacancy. But it looks like at the end of this academic year, there will be another vacancy. And partially this back and forth is because of a connection to the governor's office.
Yeah, the president there, Bernie Machen, announced his retirement and then kind of rescinded it. And I think it's pretty widely understood that he did so at the request of the governor to come back to the university. Florida obviously is a very unique university in Florida. It's, you know, the flagship university along with Florida State, but, you know, has always had that very kind of high achieving goal, and that, you know, Florida would be one of the University of Florida would be one of the best public universities in the country. So yeah, it's a really important position, and it'll be interesting to see where that discussion goes compared to what happened with Florida State.
Yeah, Tia, what is the relationship between these state universities and the governor's office? Not just under Governor Scott's administration, but under our previous administrations, and has it changed at all?
Well, I mean, when you're talking about the public universities, a large chunk, even though the chunk has kind of been decreasing during the decreased during the economic recession, a large chunk of their budgets come from the state budget. And so they're beholden to the state legislature, as well as the governor, who must sign the budget. And as well as their board of trustees and the statewide board of governors are appointed by the governor for the most part, either directly or indirectly. And so there are just a lot of things go back to the governor's office. For example, when University of Florida was looking for a president last year and they suspended the search literally a day, I think, before they were going to select a new winner.
Right.
And it was because Governor Scott spoke with the lead-in candidate. And of course, there hasn't been details of how that discussion went, but I think it's suffice to say that the governor was not sold on that person. And so I have asked if the governor has started vetting Florida State University candidates, because it's generally considered a kind of a courtesy that the governor approve whoever selected, even though he technically doesn't make the decision. And so, but I've been told that so far he has stayed out of Florida State University's search, at least actively, because of his ties to Senator Thrasher and because of the controversy. I would assume that he is a supporter of Thrasher, but from what we understand, he has not been as active as he was in the University of Florida search. And I just want to make a point about University of Florida search, if I may. It's interesting because when Governor Scott interjected himself, it was very controversial on campus. And now it hasn't been as high profile because Senator Thrasher, someone of that, you know, statewide prominence, is not involved in UF search. But there are people who are saying that, hey, look at UF. They don't even have a deadline. How serious are they about doing a national search if they haven't set an application deadline, knowing that the best candidates need a deadline?
Well, let's move. And so let's move here, Tia, from Gainesville and Tallahassee to Coral Gables with the University of Miami, because there's another search that's likely underway, and one that may not necessarily be as public to succeed Donna Shalala. Could be much different. In 2000, this search was really criticized for being too secretive. Now, the biggest challenge that Shalala faced in her tenure arguably was a 2.5-year investigation into donor Nevin Shapiro. Here in South Florida, a lot of folks remember that name. He pled guilty to running a Ponzi scheme, a big donor to UM, and the college was hit by 3-year probation from the NCAA, lost football and basketball scholarships as well. We spoke with President Shalala back in October when the penalties were first announced.
Certainly didn't help our reputation during this period, but I do think the university will recover with quality programs. We've got quality student athletes, great coaches. Our community stood with us through all of this. That even though they had the same attitude I did, and that is we should not have broken the rules, they did not withdraw their support from the university or particularly from the athletic program. we've had the most successful fundraising in our history.
That despite the penalties on the athletic programs from the NC2A and some of the donor controversies around an admitted Ponzi schemer. John O'Connor with State Impact Florida, what's the legacy of President Shalala on campus and beyond?
Well, pretty clearly she raised the profile of the university. Both the university and the medical school, the hospital, are nationally recognized now as being among the best in the country. I think the early reaction was very positive. I saw a lot of folks on social media, saying she did a really great job. This is what Miami needed. There's also some questions about, kind of the business practices of the university and did she try to expand too quickly, too fast? The university's budget more than doubled during her tenure, but a lot of that was expansion of the hospital and the medical school. 2 years ago, the medical school had massive layoffs and financial problems, and there's been some criticism of the partnership between the University of Miami Hospital and Jackson Memorial Hospital and whether or not University of Miami's hospital kind of cannibalized some of the business from Jackson.
Yeah. And in the meantime, the search for her replacement has been both at some point humorous in terms of folks that have been suggested to replace her, but it's also been very serious because, let's face it, this is an elite, albeit private school in University of Miami, that the selection process could be much different than the controversies we're seeing in Tallahassee and the questions in Gainesville.
Yeah, the last time with Shalala, it was kind of like the papal selection, from my understanding, and that the search committee kind of kept everything secret, and all of a sudden sent up the cloud of white smoke, and they said it was Donna Shalala, and the reaction was, oh, okay, that makes this okay, because she's a big name, she's got an academic background, depending on what name they come out with, and depending on how open the process is, that there may not be as welcome a reaction there.
Let's go from higher education to public education now. K-12 Palm Beach County Public School students will continue to take school assessment tests. The school board this week did not follow the path taken by the Lee County School Board, which first opted out of state tests, then opted back in after facing the possible loss of state money and keeping kids from graduating. So, John, first of all, what was behind the Palm Beach debate?
It's similar things that you've been hearing in a lot of school districts around Florida. Palm Beach, Lee County was the first to do this. Their school board actually voted to opt out of the tests. Palm Beach 2 years ago kind of led this push across the state to pass resolutions, these official statements from school boards saying, hey, we test too much, we need to cut back on this. But they had talked about kind of boycotting the tests, saw what happened in Lee County, and it sounds like they kind of had a realization that it's best not to actually break the law to make our statement, but we can do it in other ways.
Yeah, and in other ways, they talked about sending school buses up to the State House during the legislative session next spring. Tia Mitchell with the Tampa Bay Times in Tallahassee. We know that the Miami-Dade County Superintendent Alberto Carvalho, leading the largest school district in the state of Florida, has called for a pause of state testing, waiting to kind of get some ducks in a row. Has there been much of a response from Tallahassee and from state education officials to this dust up over assessments?
I think they're paying attention. However, and so I think they're paying attention, and there may be some discussion about the amount of testing, the volume of testing. But testing is not going away in Florida. You have to remember, Governor Jeb Bush introduced a lot of the accountability. And so and even though Republicans kind of are being a little bit more thoughtful about it, this is a Republican-led initiative to introduce more testing and more accountability in schools. And Governor Bush's foundation is still very influential in state politics, and they believe the testing is necessary.
Well, I can tell you it wasn't a state assessment test this week in the Hudson household, but my kindergartner got a -0 on his first math test, so we were pretty happy. Had a nice cupcake there. All right, still to come on the Florida Roundup. John O'Connor, thank you very much. Tia Mitchell with Tampa Bay Times, thank you as well from Tallahassee. Here on the way for the Florida Roundup, the deaths of about 100 Florida prison inmates are still under investigation by the state, and cops wearing cameras in South Florida. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. 3 weeks ago, the head of the Florida Corrections Agency pledged to make public a database of prisoner deaths. And this week, that database was launched. including about 100 cases that remain under investigation by law enforcement in the state of Florida. Julie Brown has been following this for the Miami Herald. Joy Fletches also covers law enforcement for the Herald. Both of them with us now here on the Florida Roundup. Julie, before we talk about this release of the database, there was some significant movement on the Department of Corrections Secretary pledge to crack down on allegations of guard abuse of prisoners just this week.
Yes. They announced the arrest of six corrections officers at a prison in Shipley, Washington County this week. They were all officers, mostly sergeants and a captain, and they were accused of felony battery of an inmate who had been restrained with handcuffs and shackles, who they had beaten, and they actually caught the beat down on some kind of a video.
What do we know about what led up to this? Do we know anything about what the guards' story have been in terms of this instance and what the prisoner has been talking about and perhaps acting?
We don't really know those details yet, but what I can tell you is it follows a pattern that I've heard from other inmates as well as correctional people who are in the system and now retired from the system, that there is a pattern that has been going on for decades with the Department of Corrections, where certain prisons have what they call goon squads, and these are corrections officers who actually do this sometimes for sport, and sometimes just to punish prisoners who don't follow their orders.
Has it been officially sanctioned by prison management?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I spoke with some of my sources inside the Department of Corrections today, and they said that this just scratches the surface, these arrests, because this has been sanctioned somewhat by management in these prisons for years and years and years. And these kinds of arrests are highly unusual, even though these kind of beatdowns have been going on for a very long time.
Highly unusual in terms of the arrests of the prison guards accused of the prisoner abuse. But Mike Cruz, the secretary of the Department of Corrections in Florida, has promised this kind of crackdown. This is part of the reform package that he mentioned just 3 weeks ago that led to this database release.
That's correct. He has promised, he said he has reviewed some of these cases and has recognized that the punishments that the system has issued in the past hasn't been as severe as it should be, and it certainly hasn't been even across the board. There are certain prisons that the guards seem to get away with this and others where they don't get away with it.
I want to talk real quick about this database. It shows us about 100 cases of prisoner deaths over the past 14 years are still under investigation. What else does it show us? What's the data show?
Well, it doesn't really show a whole lot. I mean, I guess the four people who have had loved ones die in prison, it does have their names there and where they died, and it gives you a place now to go to try to request information. But still getting information out of the Department of Corrections is very difficult, and it can be very costly for a regular citizen. I mean, we pay for these reports, and they can cost upwards of hundreds of dollars.
Well, soon there may be a video of interactions between law enforcement and the public. Some South Florida law enforcement officers will be wearing cameras. Miami Beach okaying this week, putting cameras on cops, parking, and code enforcement officers as well. Joy Fletch has covered this for the Miami Herald. This was not a unanimous decision. Only one commissioner, though, voted against it. What was the rationale?
Well, Commissioner Jonah Wolfson said that he didn't feel comfortable with the regular civilian employees recording their interactions with the public. He felt like that was a bit of an overreach. He reasoned that much the same way some say that police officers don't always have the best day. They deal with nothing but angry people a lot of the time, or people in distress. And he said much the same way these code enforcement officers can, and parking officials do the same, and might not always go well.
Majority held, though, and they likely will equip some of these parking enforcement and code enforcement officers. Again, not law enforcement per se, not police officers, right, but parking tickets and making sure that the AC code is correct and that the hallways are wide enough and clear, those kinds of things. What's the intent?
The idea, from what the city manager was telling me, is that these people, they deal with property owners who aren't always going to respond well to being called out on their violations, and this is going to protect employees from folks who maybe not necessarily always get violent, but might go back to the department and file a complaint and say, I didn't, you know, I have
What's
problems.
The union response?
I'm sorry?
What's the union response?
Oh, the union
to this?
Is pushing back. They see it as a violation of privacy on the part of the employees. Same thing for the police. They see it as it's too much. There's no. This is a way for people up top to keep track on people on the ground.
But, Julie, haven't we seen research that has shown officers who have cameras tend to have fewer public complaints filed against those departments?
Yes, I think that that's been found to be true. And I think most real good cops, cops that don't have anything to hide, I think that they're behind it. I've spoken with a lot of police officers that see it as a good thing. After all, they're being recorded anyway all over the place. Citizens pull out their cameras all the time and take video footage that could be just completely taken out of context and won't show the other person who started the fight with the cop, for example. So, you know, any decent cop, I would think, would be somewhat behind this because it'll protect them.
Of course, we're also having a bit of a debate in Miami-Dade County where the mayor, Carlos Jimenez, has proposed arming equipping officers with cameras as well. Some will say this timing is, you know, right after, of course, Ferguson, Missouri, and the protests that we saw there after an individual was shot and killed by a police officer. But the union resistance is not insignificant in this case, Joe. I mean, they've been very vocal about these privacy concerns.
They filed a grievance with the county, and it's a lot. A lot of officers I've talked to have said that you know, these cameras are just going to create more problems for cops. It's going to be a way for people to go after police officers, and it's something that a union person actually told me was that even in instances, say, like Ferguson, that video might not come out for a little while. Maybe the initial reaction that we've seen would still happen because in the end, it could be a
crime. I mean, there's got to be dollars involved, certainly. Is this a significant investment on the part of Miami Beach that is voted to approve of this?
I'd say it is. It's about $3 million over the next 2 years to roll out, and it's going to have a lot of infrastructure costs.
It's not just the cameras. It's digital cameras. How do they work?
So what they do is they always record, and when you press the button, it stores the previous 30 seconds, silent 30 seconds, no audio. That's something the manufacturer put in to try to protect privacy of the officers. But the previous 30 seconds without audio, and then whatever goes forward until you press the button again. Then you got to go and you got to upload it to the cloud. There's this, at least with Taser, the vendor that Miami Beach is using, you upload it to their cloud system. And the trick is going to be making sure you keep track of all those records carefully.
Yep.
You pay for all that space, and you got to be able to reproduce this in court.
Right. Absolutely. The prosecutors in the court, as well as the defense attorneys, are going to want to make sure all of it is legit. Joey Fletcher is covering law enforcement for the Miami Herald. Julie Brown as well, with the Miami Herald, covering the Department of Corrections. Thanks to both of you for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Finally, on the program, we're all guilty, certainly at one time or another, of ignoring the rules of the road, right? We speed, we turn right on red when we probably shouldn't. We also drive in the 95 express lane, zooming right under those big yellow signs saying closed. WLRN's Kenny Malone took a ride in the passenger seat of one of those drivers.
It's Thursday. Carlos Lora is driving north on I-95, rushing home from his job on Miami Beach to his home in Hollywood Beach to see his wife and his beloved dogs.
Roxy and Max. And they're pretty cool dogs.
Laura's not a super rich dude. He manages a condo and drives a Mini Cooper, and yet he's totally willing to pay as much as $10.50 to use the 95 express lanes to get home. But sometimes, the sign says closed.
And if it says closed, I'm guilty of still jumping on it.
But what does closed really mean? There's no mechanical arm that comes down to stop drivers from getting in the lanes. There aren't blockades placed at the entrance. It's just a yellow electronic sign. The system relies entirely on drivers like Laura doing the right thing.
Typically, whenever it's closed, it's because one lane is closed for like an accident. And once I clear that, I basically feel like I got a free ride. I don't know.
You can find out why it's difficult for FDOT to keep us off the closed 95 express lanes. You can hear the rest of the story at WLRN.org. Visit the End of the Road series. That is the Florida Roundup here, produced by Julia Duba, Gina Jordan, and Steph Farrow. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next. Ed Bell live from Studio A, the hottest shop in South Florida. Stick around for that.